Every contact leaves a trace. Known as Lacard's principle or Lacard's exchange principle, this is the basis of forensic study of trace evidence. Every perpetrator of a crime will bring something into the crime scene and leave with something from it. Both can be used as forensic evidence. Welcome to the Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen, and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out there fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we are discussing trace evidence. Trace evidence is generally thought of as any evidence so small that it can be transferred or exchanged between two surfaces without being noticed. A fiber, print, an impression. Some of these exchanges have their own dedicated specialties, such as ballistics or blood spatter. Not all evidence is actually microscopic or invisible to the naked eye. It's just the general description of evidence that is left behind in any contact between two surfaces or substances. Tire marks, footprints, tool marks, and other impressions are left behind at the contact of two objects, and that contact leaves behind a mark or removes a portion of the surface. One car hits another, and paint is left behind at the point of contact. These same traces of paint in microscopic sizes may be found on a hit-and-run victim. Tire or skid marks are left on the pavement or the shoulder of the road. Someone walks across the floor, and their shoes leave behind traces of places they have walked before. Grains of sand or soil, fibers from carpets, hair from people or pets they have been in contact with. When a gun is fired, a bullet escapes, but so does gunshot residue, gunpowder, soot, and blackening. Hairs, fibers, paint, construction materials, tape, rope, cords, glass, wood, and other plant material may all be discovered at a crime scene and used as evidence. Explosives, explosive residue, and gunshot residue can leave microscopic traces on the suspect's hands or clothing. Bacteria and body fluids such as blood, saliva, and semen can tie a suspect to a crime. During the commission of violent crimes, especially, there is a greater likelihood that fibers and other trace evidence will be left behind. While DNA may be the current star of forensic science, where it cannot be found, trace evidence is the critical link in solving the case. Paul Kirk, in his book Crime Investigation, describes it as, "Wherever he steps, whatever he touches, whatever he leaves, even unconsciously, will serve as silent witness against him. Not only his fingerprints or his footprints, but his hair, the fibers from his clothes, the glass he breaks, the tool marks he leaves, the paint he scratches, the blood or semen he deposits or collects, all of these and more bear mute witness against him. There is evidence that does not forget. It is not confused by the excitement of the moment. It is not absent because human witnesses are. It cannot perjure itself. It cannot be wholly absent. Only its interpretation can err. Only human failure to find it, study, and understand it can diminish its value. Trace evidence may be found where the crime occurred, along all paths of entry or exit, and in any related areas where evidence may have been moved to or discarded. It is the responsibility of anyone arriving at a crime scene to act in such a way as to least compromise the evidence. While we want to preserve evidence of immediate utility, in many cases, preserving evidence can be especially useful in investigations that span years or decades, where the perpetrator was not immediately recognized. Over a four-month period in 1990 in Spokane, Washington, three women were killed. Yolanda Sapp, 26, Nikki Lowe, 34, and Kathy Brisboy, 38. All three were sex workers who were killed in the same area with what seemed to be the same small caliber 22 gun. There were many other similarities in the crime scenes. These three women were originally thought to be victims of serial killer Robert Yates. However, the MO didn't match that of the Yates killings. They realized that they had another serial killer on their hands. In 2005, when science, specifically of DNA, had advanced well beyond that of 1990, the fingernail clippings of Kathy Brisboy were submitted for testing. However, there was no match. In 2009, a full DNA profile of the killer was developed, but there was no match in the system. In 2012, a 60-year-old woman is picked up by the police because she is a known felon attempting to buy ammunition and a magazine for a firearm. Due to new laws, there is a federal requirement, as well as ones in many states, once you are incarcerated, you are required to submit a DNA sample. The DNA submitted by this woman, Donna Perry, is a direct match to the DNA found under the fingernail of Kathy Brisboy. Prior to this match, police had never heard of Donna Perry in connection to this case. They certainly had not expected a woman to be their prime suspect. However, Donna Perry had previously been known as Douglas Perry. In his 20s, Douglas Perry was known to the police due to a series of assault charges and weapons violations. In his 30s, police found a huge stash of weapons in his home, 50 firearms, huge amounts of ammunition, and a pipe bomb, and he's charged with federal weapons violations. He was known to always have dozens of weapons and thousands of rounds of ammunition every time he was arrested. After the federal charges, he was no longer legally allowed to own guns. After the murders, he goes to prison again for another weapons violation. While in prison, mental health workers raise alarms over his obsession with prostitutes. The root of his obsession was his disgust over them wasting their ability to reproduce when he was unable to do so himself. While in jail, he tells another inmate that he has killed around 9 prostitutes because he hated them. Nobody believed him. He was released from prison. About a year later, he picks up another prostitute and takes her back to his hotel room, where she is confronted by Douglas's huge selection of weapons. She is naturally spooked and reports him to the cops after their interaction. When the cops stop and question him, there are notes from a medical professional that describe him as having gender psychosis disorder and an intense hatred of women. The next year, he flies to Bangkok, Thailand, and has gender reassignment surgery, and returns home as Donna Perry. Donna Perry also had a record of weapons violations, but now her DNA opened a new line of inquiry. In investigating Douglas Perry and trying to tie him to the crimes her DNA had implicated her in, they did a full inquiry into his history, locations, residences, vehicles, ties to the victims, etc. 22 years after the murders, Donna Perry was arrested for the crimes after an investigator found that the fibers on all three victims matched the vehicle that she had owned at the time of the murders. Despite the fact that she had sold said vehicle shortly after the murders, detectives managed to track it down to perform the comparison. A 22 caliber bullet that matched those used in the murders was also found in the vehicle. DNA and fingerprint evidence were also cited in the trial. Harry's defense that while Douglas may have committed the crimes, they shared DNA, Donna was not the same person and therefore not responsible for his crimes. Detectives found her gender irrelevant to their guilt in the crime, but tried to be as respectful as possible. They just wanted their perpetrator, whoever it was. Whoever she was now, at the time Douglas committed the crimes, he knew it was wrong. Donna would have to pay for the crimes of her past life. On July 24th, 2017, Harry was sentenced to 3 life sentences without the possibility of parole due to DNA and trace evidence, despite her insistence that she had no involvement in the crimes. By his own admission, from 1981 to 1984, Bobby Joe Long committed at least 50 rapes before moving on to murder. He operated as the classified killer. Long would contact women through the Penny Saver and other classified ads. He would use these ads to target potential victims and arrange to meet them to purchase their items. Once he found a woman alone, he asked to use the bathroom, took out his rape kit, and raped and robbed the woman. He also picked up sex workers, drove them to remote areas, and raped them. Eventually, Long abducted, raped, and murdered at least 10 women. In 1984, DNA evidence was not yet a thing, and even if it had been, his victims were primarily sex workers. Instead, the red carpet fibers of his 1978 Dodge Magnum helped tie him to his crimes. He killed 10 women over 8 months in 1984. He was extremely prolific, with a short to non-existent cooldown period. The profile generated by the FBI from his murders stated that he would either be caught, move to a new area, or continue to kill indefinitely. Police were frantic to catch him, but had few leads for a suspect despite the trace evidence tying his crimes together. He didn't even have a concrete MO. While his signature included strangling victims, he also slit the throats of some and shot others. He was ultimately caught after he abducted Lisa McVeigh on November 3, 1984. He let her live and ultimately signed his own death warrant. Lisa was not a sex worker like most of his previous victims had been, but just a young woman that was snatched off the street. He was blindfolded when he abducted her and uncharacteristically took her to his home, but she was determined to survive and to learn everything that she could about her attacker. Lisa also wanted to leave as much evidence of herself behind in his home as she could, in case she died, but also to corroborate her story if she was able to survive. Because Lisa was determined to survive, she did everything that she could to get out of the situation alive. She decided to play along with her attacker. She remained calm and compliant throughout his attacks. She started acting young and naive and played along with his games. Lisa also began planning what she could do to get Long caught. The next day, she convinced him to let her go to the bathroom alone. While she couldn't escape from there, she could leave evidence of her presence behind. She touched every surface in that room that she could leave her fingerprints behind. The next time he assaulted her, she asked to caress his face and use this to learn his features and appearance, despite being blindfolded. Then she began to spin a tale of a sick father, of whom she was the sole caregiver, to gain his confidence and sympathy. It worked, and unexpectedly, he released her. This decision was the beginning of his downfall. Lisa went to the police. They didn't believe her at first. She was too calm and collected to be telling the truth in their eyes. No victim would act as she was or how she had described. However, eventually, she found a police officer that would listen to her. He began to hear the similarities to the open homicides he had been investigating. Even though she had been blindfolded the entire time, She could see the tiniest bit underneath the blindfold, and she took in as many details as she could. Most importantly, she described the car that her attacker drove, including the carpets inside and the vehicle's mismatched tires. Mismatched tire prints had been found at the other crime scenes. Red trilobal carpet fibers had been consistently found on 7 of the 8 bodies to date, and this information had not been released or leaked to the media. These fibers were also found on Lisa's clothing. Her description of the model and appearance of the vehicle was enough to generate a lead for the officers. A routine traffic stop of a matching vehicle, where officers pretended to be looking for a robbery suspect, resulted in a name for the murder suspect, and Lisa was able to identify Long in a photo lineup as her attacker. Her recollection of her abductor stopping at an ATM was also matched to Long. He was arrested, and when confronted with the evidence that the police had, he confessed to the abduction of Lisa. He initially denied the murders. However, when officers told him about the red fibers that were found on Lisa and many of his victims and had been matched to his car, he did confess and even revealed a ninth victim that the police were unaware of at this point. When the body of what is believed to be his first victim was discovered a short time later, he confessed again. His victim count totaled 10. However, it is suspected that there may be more victims that have not been discovered or linked to Long. In another case, Wayne Bertram Williams, convicted murderer and suspected serial killer, is believed to be responsible for at least 24 murders between 1979 and 1981, also known as the Atlanta Child Murders. Williams is serving life imprisonment for the 1981 killings of two men in Atlanta, Georgia, but has never been tried for the additional child murders. Williams first became a suspect in the Atlanta murders on the morning of May 22, 1981, when a police surveillance team watching a spot where multiple bodies of victims of the Atlanta child murders had been suspected of being dumped were parked near the James Jackson Parkway Bridge spanning the Chattahoochee River. A member of the surveillance team heard a big, loud splash. This suggested to them that something had been thrown from the bridge into the river below. As they closely watched, the next automobile to exit the bridge after the splash belonged to Williams, but no one had actually seen Williams throw anything into the water. When he was stopped and questioned, he told the police that he was on his way to check on an address in a neighboring town ahead of the audition the following morning with a young singer named Cheryl Johnson. However, both the phone number he gave the police and Cheryl Johnson turned out to be fictitious. 2 days later, the nude body of 27-year-old Nathaniel Cater was discovered in the river. Cater had been missing for 4 days and was reportedly last seen with Williams. Police suspected that Williams had killed Cater and thrown his body over the bridge. In addition to the murder of Cater, Williams was a suspect in the murder of Jimmy Ray Payne. Hairs and fibers that were retrieved from the body of Payne were found to be consistent with those from Williams' home, car, and dog. Co-workers told police that they had seen Williams with scratches on his face and arms around the time of the murders, which investigators surmised could have been inflicted by victims during struggles. Williams was arrested for the murders of Cater and Payne, both of which had been found in the Chattahoochee River in the same area as some of the child victims. During his 2-month trial, prosecutors matched 19 sources of fibers from Williams' home and car: his bedspread, bathroom, gloves, carpets, clothes, dog, and an unusual trilobal carpet fiber to the victims. Prosecution was able to introduce 10 other deaths that were suspected to be connected to Williams, 10 victims of the Atlanta child murders. Evidence included witness testimony that placed Williams with several victims while they were alive and highlighted inconsistencies in his accounts of his whereabouts. The jury found him guilty of the murders of Cater and Payne, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. This may be an unpopular opinion, but my conflict with this case is that Williams was never tried for, nor convicted of, the Atlanta child murders, But the police's suspicion of William's involvement in these cases was brought up during his murder trial. This sounds to me like prejudicial information. The victim types of the murders Williams was convicted of, and the children were of very disparate ages. However, there were suspicions and possible evidence to connect Williams to the child murders. I just think he should have been tried for the child murders, or the evidence excluded from the trial for the crimes he was being tried for. Microscopic traces of green trilobal fibers were found on several of the child victims, as well as the victims that Williams was tried for, as well as dog hair and other trace materials. After 20 victims, the media was told that fibers and dog hairs were being found on the clothing of the child victims that were found in the woods. After that, the next bodies were dumped in a river, stripped to their underwear. This is similar to the adult victims in this case. When Williams was identified as a possible suspect, a search of his home yielded a green carpet in his bedroom that matched the fibers found on the victims, as well as fibers from his car, a leather jacket that was found in his closet, and hair from his dog. Jurors and investigators were unable to dismiss that so many fibers on so many victims were matched to Williams and his possessions. Despite eyewitness testimony, William maintains that he had never met any of the victims, and the fiber evidence had to be planted or manufactured. Some people believe his assertion that he is innocent, including at least one of the mothers of a child victim. Many people assert that the strangulation death stopped when Williams was arrested, but he claims that people just stopped looking once his guilt was assumed. Williams almost won an appeal based on the evidence, but five of the six justices hearing the case denied his appeal and voted to uphold the verdict. The dissenting justice felt that the fiber evidence fell short of scientific certainty and that the prosecution should not have been able to use the so-called pattern evidence on 10 other murders. The latter is the same objection that I noted earlier in this discussion. The dissenting judge also called the defense ineffective, which the defense attorney does not deny. He stated that she felt hampered by the lack of funds, time, and resources. One of the witnesses who had testified as to the motive in this case was shown to have perjured himself in regards to his name, and he was hiding in an extensive criminal record. When Williams was convicted of the two murders he had been officially charged with, the book was closed on 21 other cases, and no further investigation took place. I do believe in the fiber evidence in this case. The green carpet fibers found on the victims were fairly unique in that they came from a carpet that was over a decade old and part of a short run. It was not a common type of fiber, but it was a very distinctive one. Also, in recent years, hairs found on one of the victims were tested for DNA. The DNA profile obtained excluded over 97% of the population, but did not exclude Williams. However, Williams has not and will not be tried for the murder of any of these child victims, so the prosecution is satisfied that Williams is already serving a life sentence. In each of these cases, the perpetrators were caught and convicted based on trace evidence that they left behind on their victims. Think of all the things that you come in contact with on an average day. What traces of yourself are you leaving behind? What is leaving its trace on you? I'd love to hear from you on social media or email about this topic or any future ones you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder. It can also be reached at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast to continue hearing about the science of murder. Next week, we'll discuss the science of DNA in murder investigations. Please leave a review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast provider, and encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us.